material of myth is the material of our life, the material of our body, and the material of our environment. And a living, vital mythology deals with these in terms that are appropriate to the nature knowledge of the time. The imagery of the human body is really the founding imagery of myth. This, I would say, is the basic image of mythology. The first experience of anybody is the mother's body. And what Lévi-Bruhl called participation mystique, this mystic participation between the mother and child and the child and the mother, is the final happy land. The earth and the whole universe as our mother carries this experience into the larger sphere of adult experience. And when one can feel oneself in relation to the universe in the same complete and natural way as that of the child with the mother, one is in complete harmony and tune with the universe. And I would say getting into harmony and tune with the universe and staying there is the principal function of mythology. The problem when societies develop out of the earlier primeval condition is to keep the individual in this participation mystique with the society. Now, looking around, you see how little chance we have, particularly if you live, as I do, in New York. Also, in relation to this, we have the problem of the woman and the man in relation to mythological experience. In spite of what our new unisex movement is stating, their differences are radical from the very beginning to the end. And this is not a culturally conditioned situation. Here is an earlier little Madonna. This is one of Jane Goodall's chimpanzee friends. Now, one of the problems in the human development is that of the long infancy. The child, until 15 or so, is in a situation of dependency on the parents. And this attitude of dependency, the attitude of submission to authority, expecting approval, fearing discipline, this is the prime condition of the psyche. And it is drilled in. Also, the particular mores, the particular notions of good and evil and roles to play of the society are imprinted. What is born is a blank. It's a little biological creature living spontaneously out of its nature. But immediately it's born, the society begins putting its imprinting upon it, in the mother body and the whole attitude of the mother. You can have a gentle, loving mother, or you can have one who is resentful of the birth at all. And then this conditions a whole psychological out-of-adjustment situation. I was surprised to hear from Jane Goodall that the young chimpanzee also has a long period of dependency on the mother. And one of the psychological problems of the chimp is the same as that which the human being faces, namely, after weaning and disengagement, to become actually psychologically disengaged from the mother. Now, here's a mother with a child who has not become psychologically disengaged. This is the newborn little Merlin, and she's pregnant, ready for another birth. Here is a woman in New Guinea in exactly the same situation. Now, until very, very recently, the condition of the female in the human society has been that of service to the coming and maintenance of life, of human life. That's her whole function. The woman is in the role of the center, and continuator of nature. The man is not. He has a very short and unimportant, finally, relationship to this whole problem. He has another set of concerns. Here go Jane Goodall's males out to work. Now, she tells that they control an area of some 30 miles circumference, and they know where the bananas are. And when the bananas are failing in this area, they know where to go for more. They also are defenders. They defend against invasions by other little tribes and so forth. And just in the primary way, the function of the male in this society is to prepare and maintain a field within which the female can bring forth the future. And these are two quite different roles. And the bodies are made for them as well. Now, the male is not engaged like the woman in a constant charge of children and so forth. He has a lot of free time. He knows where the bananas are. It isn't time to go there now. Nobody's bothering us. So what do we do? This is it. In men's clubs, delousing each other. And here we have from Australia a comparable community. Now this whole thing, which very sadly, I would say today, is being invaded and destroyed, the idea of the men's club where no women are allowed is a very important social institution. One of the saddest indications today of what's happening is in New York City, in the Princeton Club, a little panel on the floor, entry into the bar that says, "Here we get away from the women." And you go in there today, and all these women alumni of Princeton are in the bar. So this is a long-standing institution. The men's hunting team, together, whatever. Now here they are defending the community. It was something to hear this beautiful woman, Jane Goodall, go across the stage bellowing and howling to let us know what this sounded like, and she could imitate it to perfection. Now, this is the male job, and here we are in New Guinea. These are hill tribes people. Now, the interesting thing about this is that this is a ceremonial battle, and serious. In this area, in Highland New Guinea, there's plenty of food. There's no need for one tribe to invade another to get their property. What are the men going to do? They're sitting around, nothing to do, so they invent a war. This is a war game, and the spears are serious. So when one is killed, the battle ends, and then we have a period of waiting for another surprise attack. So this gives the men something to do all the time. They're on the guard against the other one launching the return attack. They're preparing for it and so forth. And the male has to have something serious to do, that's all. Now here we go back to the animal world again. There are a couple of stallions fighting over a mare. There she stands, and she doesn't care who wins. Somebody's going to take her on. Now, the male body is built for this sort of thing, and it's a fact. In the human body, every muscle has an impulse to action, and one is not fully alive unless one is in action. And so we have the invention always in societies of games of strength, games of cleverness, games of winning, and here we are in Greece. Now, in the male community, what is important is the ranking, the pecking order, what Jane Goodall called alpha male. Who is alpha male? Who's top male? This, which we see here, is a charging display. This fellow's coming down the line, pulling down branches and so forth, and anyone who wants to claim top male position has to challenge him in this action. Here's a guy coming to take him on. And the winner is top male. She describes one little fellow who was anything but a top male, who found that by kicking oil cans around, he could make quite an impression. And for a couple of days until everyone else caught on, he was top male. Now, she describes a very interesting episode, which strikes me, and I bring it forward simply as a little suggestion. She was seated on a hill slope, observing through glasses a number of her chimpanzee friends over on the opposite slope of the valley. There were half a dozen males and females to the same number, about, and a few of the little ones. And it was pouring rain. We're in the tropics, pouring rain, and a rumbling of thunder. And then suddenly, there was a prodigious thunderclap, and the males went bananas. They started charging displays one after another, just down the line. Big boy up there. Now, when I heard that, I recalled that Giambattista Vico, the 17th century philosopher, had suggested that the first notion of the Godhead arose out of experiencing the voice of the thunder. The voice in the thunder is the first suggestion of a power greater than that of the human system. Now, the male chimpanzee is almost twice as heavy as the female. There's no question about physical supremacy here. And this goes largely for the male-female in the human sphere as well. And this is Theseus abducting Antiope, the queen of the Amazons. This power of the male and the female submission to it, the female is physically vulnerable. Also, she is booty. And one of the problems of the male is to protect the females of the community from abduction. And so this is a long-standing situation, and the breeding of the race favors these two opposed physical organizations. And so the myths have to deal with this. And the male body and the female body have their symbolic values throughout the system. Now, as for biological spontaneity, here is the mother, this is her older daughter, and here's our little friend Merlin. I think this is Merlin. The young female chimp takes her younger brother or sister as a doll and is imitating mother and playing with the child, and the mother has to be careful that nothing happens because it's a bit of a clumsy operation. The males don't do this. The young male starts pushing young females around. Then he starts pushing older females around. And then when he gets to be really big and strong, he enters the men's group and finds his place in the pecking series. Two entirely different spontaneities, two very different natures. Now the next thing. It used to be thought that the thing that distinguished man from the beast was his tool making. Homo habilis, man the tool maker. This is a female chimp who has made a sheaf of straws like this, has pulled the leaves off and prepared a system of tools for herself. What she is doing is poking this reed down a termite hole. And the termites down there grab it. And then she draws it out and licks them off. And after she's done this for a half hour or so, this stick begins to get soft. So she throws it away, picks up the next one she's prepared, and goes on. We'll go on for 2 or 3 hours this way, like some woman eating candy and reading a French novel. But she's actually got tools here. Now, here's a male with a tool, a weapon, threatening. What he's threatening, what he's fighting there, is a mirror reflection of himself. So we know who's going to win. But please notice the legs. Now we come to an artist's representation of an Australopithecine. This is one of the, well, perhaps the earliest grade of hominid that has yet been identified. This is in South and East Africa. This type of creature is now being pushed back to something like 4 or 5 million years ago. He has picked up a tool and is running, but the important thing are the legs. Apparently, the first essential development of the hominid, distinguishing him from the arboreal ape, is this kind of running leg. That released the hands. The way in which the apes walk is with this knuckle use of the front legs or arms. Compare these legs with the beautiful legs of Jane Goodall here. And this is the first thing. It used to be thought the brain enlargement was the main distinction. Not so anymore. It's the legs. This leaves the hands free for manipulation, and then the brain increases. Here is a hand from southern Ethiopia from 4.5 million years ago. There was never knuckle walking on those bones. There's a human hand already, 4.5 million years ago. Now, this first type of human being, when we get above the Australopithecine, which has the brain capacity simply of an ape, is the Homo habilis, as he's now called, with a brain capacity a little larger than that of a male gorilla, something like 980 or 60 or between 60 and 80 cubic centimeters. Beyond that, then, we come to the second grade of man, known now as Homo erectus, the first example of which was Pithecanthropus from Java, called Java Man. The brain capacity here is up around and slightly over 1,000 cubic centimeters. And here we have a tool from this date, about 500,000 BC in this case. It's a practical tool. If apes could handle stone and break it, the tool would be a practical tool of this kind. But I want to show you something that, for me, represents the emergence of a human type of consciousness, the birth, you might say, of the spiritual life, such as no animal would ever have prepared, and is this tool here. This is from 500,000 BC and was found on the banks of the River Thames. It's larger than what would be useful. This is about 6 or 8 inches long. But what Robertson Jeffers, the California poet, calls divinely superfluous beauty is here. Now, there are two types of human being. There's the animal human being, who is practical, and there's the human being, who is susceptible to the allure of beauty, which is divinely superfluous. This is the distinction. It's the first little germ of a spiritual concern and need of which the animals know nothing. Since that is larger than what would be practical, the suggestion is that it must have been used in some sort of ritual context. So there is a slight suggestion here of the probability, if not the possibility, if not the probability, of some sort of ritual action, probably associated with the meat or food that is to be eaten. We come now to Homo sapiens. This is the first order of Homo sapiens neanderthalensis, Neanderthal man. He used to be the one that was called the ape man, but we find that his brain capacity in some cases is over 1,600 cubic centimeters. And the brain capacity average today is less than 1,600 cubic centimeters. So we've got to pay our respect to this chap. It was a tremendously powerful figure that emerged and took the land just south of the great glaciers of the Virum glaciation, the last glaciation, appearing somewhere around 200,000 BC and surviving until about 40,000 BC. That's a long, long season. And I want to stress him. This is Homo sapiens. The brain has come to a certain size, and there is a transformation of consciousness, and it's at this period that the first infallible signs of mythological thinking appear. And they appear in two aspects. And the first is this of burials. What we see in this is a burial from about 60,000 BC from Mount Carmel in what's now Palestine. And this form here is the jawbone of a boar. In other words, a sacrificial offering has been associated with the burial. The burial is in the crouched position of the fetus, returned to the womb. This is the first experience of mystery beyond that of the magic of divine superfluous beauty. This character was our friend, walking around, warm, talking. He lies down, something departs, it's cold, stiff, and begins then to decay. What has left him? The notion that what has left is still alive is what we experience here. Burial with grave gear. It's in this period of Neanderthal man that the first burials appear. Some remarkable burials have recently been found in northern Iran and Iraq, in that area there, of Neanderthal men from about 60,000 BC. And there's one in a site called Shanidar, where a male, powerful male, was buried with flowers on top of him. The pollens remain and have been identified, most of them of medicinal plants. He may have been a shaman of some kind. But beyond that, beneath him were the bones of two women and a child. Do we have a sati burial here already? This is, we don't know. Date about 60,000 BC. So, the human spirit lives on beyond the wall of time that we know, and one relates to it. Here is one of Jane Goodall's apes, whose tiny little thing here has died of the polio. There was a polio plague that struck the little community. And this poor woman had no idea what had happened here and just walked around for days holding this little thing in its hand until it began to stink. Then she takes it over her shoulder, walks off into the forest, and comes back without it. Something has happened. There's no conscious relationship to it. There's no way to handle it, turn it into something significant. That is the opposite to the human experience system. Now we go back to Neanderthal times. I said there were two signs of the beginning of mythological experience and thinking. First was human burial. The second is worship of cave bear skulls. In the high Alps of Switzerland and Silesia, there have been found half a dozen small cave chapels in which there are cave bear skull caches, hiding places where cave bear skulls have been kept. Some of them have rings of stone around them. Other ones, like this one, has the long bone of the bear in the bear's mouth as though the bear were eating its own flesh. Others have the long bones poked through the eyes, fear of the evil eye, apparently. But just as the human being who has died is still there, so is the animal who has been killed still there, and we have to take care of revenge, malice, and so forth. Now, the typical system of belief among hunting people who are killing and eating animals all the time and do not feel, as we do, that the animal is a lower form of life. The animal is an equivalent form in another aspect and is revered, is respected, and yet killed. The basic mythic theme of hunting cultures is the animal is a willing sacrifice, comes willingly to be killed. You can find this in the myths all over the place. But comes with the understanding that will be killed with gratitude, that a ceremonial will be conducted to return its life to the mother source for rebirth, so that it will come again next year. And then there is the idea of a specific animal that is the, you might say, alpha animal, to whom the prayers and worship are addressed that are to concern the entire animal community. As though there were a covenant between the animal and the human communities, honoring the mystery of nature, which is life lives by killing. No other way. And it is the one life in two manifestations that is living this way, by killing and eating itself. And so perhaps already in this figure of the cave bear skull consuming its own flesh, we have that image of what life is. This, I think, is the prime image. Now, we don't kill the animals we eat. We have butchers who do that. And the food comes all nicely packed, particularly in the shopping centers. And you see people throwing this one around that, oh, I'll take this and put it. It's a different attitude. These people thank the animal for having given itself. We thank our notion of divinity for having given us this meal. It's a totally different psychology, a totally different mythology. The prime one is this, of life in its various manifestations consuming itself. Now in Japan, in northern Japan, in Hokkaido, there remain a race of people that are Caucasoid, not Mongoloid. And these are known as the Ainu, A-I-N-U. And their principal cult is a bear cult. And here we have an Ainu shrine, and there is a bear skull. This is today. This is 40 to 60,000 years later than the forms that I've been showing you. The conservatism of primitive man is basic. To change a form, even of a tool, is to lose its power. And so you have here a cult from 60,000 BC, still in northern Japan among the Ainu people. There is a sanctuary of black bear skulls of the Ainu, the counterpart of the caves that I showed you from 60,000 years ago. Now, this idea, the animal master, is basic. The covenant of the animals, the notion of the physical as being secondary to the spiritual life energy, a ritual of thanks and of returning the energy to its source for another visit. Now we come to Homo sapiens sapiens, Cro-Magnon man. This order of the human species appears around 30,000 to 40,000 BC and appears not only in Europe, where he was first discovered, but also in Southeast Asia and in two or three other places, as though there were a parallel evolution taking place. This reconstruction by McGregor is based on the first Cro-Magnon skull that was found in the Dordogne. It's known as the Old Man of Cro-Magnon, and this is the man who, in those great caves, did those beautiful works of art. And now we have the first images. These Paleolithic Venus figurines, as they're called. They stand a few inches high. There are now something like 200 of these have been found in a belt stretching from the Atlantic coast of France and Spain right across Asia to Lake Baikal on the borders of China. They're all of essentially the same type. They no accent on the face at all, no face whatsoever. Great emphasis on the breasts and hips and loins, that is to say, the miracle of the female body, the mystery of the female body, which gives birth to life and nourishment to life, that mother that we were talking about in the beginning. No feet, and this is explained simply by knowing that they were made to stand up in little household altar shrines. And two or three have been found, actually, in situ. These little figures are associated with dwelling sites, rock shelves under which the community lived. They do not appear in the big caves, dwelling sites. This is the mother of life. She is symbolic of that which all women incarnate. This is from a shelf in France called Lozelle. It's a very important and suggestive figure. This little Venus of Lozelle is holding in her hand, in her right hand, elevated, a bison horn with 13 vertical strokes. That's the number of nights between the first crescent and the full moon. The other hand is on the belly. What is suggested, we don't have any words of writing from this period, what is suggested is a recognition of the equivalence of the menstrual and the lunar cycles. This would be the first inkling we have of a recognition of counterparts between the celestial and earthly rhythms of life. Now, there's a man, Alexander Marshak, has published a formidable volume called The Roots of Civilization, where he deals with a number of staves or staffs of this kind, which are notched. And he has studied a number of these with a microscope and finds that the notches were not made by the same instrument at the same time on any one piece. And he says these are probably time-factored counts. Counts, many of them suggesting very strongly counts of the lunar cycle. So it may be out of women's concern for this rhythm that they will have recognized in their own bodies that we come to mathematical and even astronomical reckoning. This figure is known as the Venus of Lespugue. It has been damaged, and so it isn't as beautiful as it must once have been. But what I want, why I'm presenting this to demonstrate, is that these are not naturalistic. They are aesthetic compositions. Brancusi might have been interested in this. The whole magic of the woman is brought here into one circle, the breasts and the hips brought down together. And then you have that elegant sweep of the chest to the head, and then the feet that where she was made to stand in a little shrine. These figures date from around 18,000 BC, the Magdalenian times, or perhaps even earlier. Now we turn to the problem of the male in this society, and now we go into the great big temple caves. I tell you, nobody would live in these caves. They're cold, they're dangerous, they're dark, and they are frightening. And the general consensus, I think, of scholarship is that they represent the sanctuaries of the men's rights, where boys were turned into men. And what they had to learn was courage. They had to undergo death and resurrection rituals where they die to their dependent infancy and come to maturity in, as self-responsible, active, protecting, active males. And they have to learn also not only the art of the hunt, but also the rituals of the hunt. Now, this particular figure is known as the Sorcerer of Trois Frères. There's an enormous cave, something like a mile in its reaches, in the Pyrenees. The cave is called Les Trois Frères because three brothers playing with their dog discovered it. The dog fell down a hole, and when they went down that hole, they came into this fantastic cave. The main chamber is an enormous chamber with this figure dominant, let's say, over there. Now that chamber is entered through artificial openings. But originally, apparently, it could be entered only through a long flume, like a pipe, about 50 to 75 yards long, through which one had to crawl, as though it were a rebirth theme. And one of the great scholars in this field, Herbert Kuhn, has described crawling through that darn thing. And if you're susceptible at all to claustrophobia, you'll hardly get through. Well, here one can imagine a team of four or five youngsters being sent through that. And when they come out the other end, this is what's looking at them. And all around the rest of the cave are engravings of animals, the animals of the great hunting plains. Because the hunting plains were abundant in animals, like the animals at Serengeti Plain now in Africa. Now this figure is part human, part animal. This is the animal master now in a ritual context. The evidence, and I'll show a little bit later, for shamanic action in these periods is very convincing. He has a lion body, and the placement of the genitalia in the rear like that is of the feline. The legs are of a man. The eyes are possibly of an owl or of a lion. Then the antlers of the stag. Now the stag loses its antlers annually and brings them back again, and so is, as it were, an incarnation of the forest spirit. Any animal that has an annual cycle, for instance, the peacock losing its tail feathers and so forth and so on, becomes symbolic of the process that moves in the seasons. So this is the mysterious sorcerer of Les Trois Frères. Does he represent a deity or does he represent a shaman? There's been an argument on this, and it doesn't make any difference whatsoever because the shaman in that form would be the deity. So we keep thinking of deity as a kind of fact somewhere, you know, God as a fact. God is simply our own notion of something that is symbolic of transcendence and mystery. The mystery is what's important, and that could be incarnate in a man, in an animal, not incarnate, but recognized in a man or in an animal. George Catlin in the northern Missouri River, among the Mandan Indians, does this painting of a Mandan shaman, an animal man. And here we go back to one of the caves of France, and there you have the same dancing figure. Now we come to another extraordinary thing. In the great cave of Lascaux in the Dordogne, in what's called the Rotunda, an enormous chamber, there's a frieze of animals, runs along here, and over on the left corner is this strange beast with these strange horns. No animal in the world looks like that. And yet these artists can paint animals in a way that no one's been able to paint them since. So what did they have in mind here? We will go to Australia. It's remarkable, the continuity from these caves to Australia and what we can find. And here is an Australian elder with the same pointing sticks, they're called there, and here are two more. Now the pointing stick has been described at length by Geza Roheim in his study of Australian psychology. The pointing stick is a negative phallus. Instead of generating, it kills. And with certain whispered magical charms, it is pointed as between the legs in the direction of the enemy. And the enemy will then be killed by being ripped open from the rectum to the genitals. We go now back to Lascaux. We go down into the crypt, a lower chamber, and this famous image appears. This definitely is a shaman. He's got the masked head of a bird on his bâton de commandement. We have a bird form. Here is the erect phallus, the negative phallus, the pointing stick, and by miracle, a lance has struck through the animal master here, which is a bison, and opened up his guts exactly as the pointing stick would have worked. This particular figure has has brought about a great deal of discussion. Some of the writers have suggested it represents a hunting accident. That is ridiculous. What we know about magic would indicate that if a hunting accident were depicted in the most sacred place of a sacred cave, it would produce hunting accidents by sympathetic magic. What it certainly represents is the bison. The principal animal of the hunt is the principal animal master. The bison invoked in the name of the covenant, animals giving their life willingly through the power of the shaman and thus killed. That's the best explanation I can find of this event. And now, the whole idea of the men's sacred ground, the men's cave, is continued in ceremonial huts, which are associated with the rebirth. And you see the tiny little door, as though this were the vulva. And one goes in to the mother body, and everything inside is magical. We're in a magical field. And the men who are in there are not this individual, that individual, another individual. They are in a role. They are, as the people in Brazil would say, they are here menstruating. And say they are the experiences now of the energy of nature coming through them. And so we come to Notre Dame de Chartres. Our mother, church, the mother body. And when you're in there, you're in the magic realm again. The imagery is that of dream. The imagery is that of myth. The imagery is that of reference to transcendence. And here, on the West Port La Chartres, here is the mandala, actually symbolic of the vulva and the womb, and the second coming, the birth from this. And then just as there was the great prime magician, so we have Pope Innocent III. Now there are two ways of coming into this role. One is temporarily for the ceremony, or another is permanently. Here is a Maori chieftain permanently in the role. That's tattooing. And his whole body is tattooed like that. He's got a magical body. That is to say, the stained glass windows and incense and all have been imprinted on him. He's in the cathedral all the time, you might say. His life is that of a mythological role. This is marriage, where one becomes, in one's marriage, one member of a twofold being. This beautiful thing is from Athens, 5th century, red-figured ceramic piece, and it shows a woman initiating a man. Actually, in marriage, woman is the initiator. She's the one closer to nature and to what it's all about. He's just coming in for illumination. This becomes especially interesting when we read who these people are. This is Thetis, and this is Peleus. This is the mother, and this is the father of Achilles. So it is a marriage. Thetis was a beautiful nymph with whom Zeus fell in love. Then he learned that her son would be greater than his father, and so Zeus thought better of the relationship and withdrew, and saw to it that she should marry a human husband. And so Peleus is her human husband, and she is a goddess. And the text tells us that when he went to take her in marriage, she transformed herself into a serpent, into a lion, into fire, into water, but he conquered her. Well, that's not what you see here at all. She has power that is symbolized in serpent and in lion. Now let me repeat the basic story of the sense of these two symbols. The serpent sheds its skin to be born again, as the moon sheds its shadow to be born again. And the serpent, therefore, like the moon, is a symbol of lunar consciousness. That is to say, life and consciousness, life energy and consciousness incorporated in a temporal body. Consciousness and life engaged in the field of time, of birth and death. The lion is associated with the sun. It is the solar animal. The sun does not carry a shadow in itself. The sun is permanently disengaged from the field of time and birth and death, and so is absolute life. These two are the same energy, one disengaged, the other engaged. And the goddess is the mother personification of both energies. Let us now see what's happening to the youth. One serpent is biting him here between the eyes, opening the eye of inner vision that sees past the display of the field of time and space. Second serpent biting under the ear, opening the ear to the song of the music of the spheres, the music, the voice of the universe. The third serpent is biting the heel, the bite of the Achilles tendon, the bite of death. Dying to one's little ego and becoming a vehicle of the knowledge of the transcendent. Becoming transparent to transcendence. That was the sense of the initiations that we've been reading about. The woman becomes a vehicle at the time of her menstruation. And the man in his ceremonial is a vehicle as well. And so, the world of art. The two hands, now this is important. Good and evil together. The yin-yang cycle, the Chinese. The mystical dimension is beyond good and evil. The ethical dimension is in the field of good and evil. And one of the problems in our religions lies in the fact that it's accenting right from the very start the good and evil problem. Christ comes to atone for a sin, evil atonement. It struck me some months or years perhaps ago that the first people to listen to St. Paul were the merchants of Corinth. And so we have the vocabulary of debt and payment in our interpretation of the mythic themes. Whereas in the Orient, the interpretations in terms of ignorance and illumination, not debt and payment. And the debt and payment thing goes haywire when you realize there was no Garden of Eden, there was no fall of man, and so there was no offense to God, and so what's all this about paying a debt? You have to read the symbols in another vocabulary now. Furthermore, with the assumption and ascension to heaven, what heaven? Going at the speed of light, the bodies would not be out of the galaxy yet. Your mythology, your imagery, has to keep up with what you know of the universe, because what it has to do is put you in accord with the universe as known, not as it was known 2000 BC in the Near East. Well, anyhow, this is the marriage initiation. This beautiful one. This is from a wall in Pompeii. This young man is being initiated. Here's the initiator, and here's the initiator's assistant, and the boy is told, look in this bowl, it's a metal bowl, and you will see your own face, your own true face. The bowl is of such a concavity inside that what he's going to see is not his own face at all, but this face of old age held behind him. And isn't that a shock? He is being introduced to what our American Indians call the long body, the whole body of your life from birth to death. And so, again, the mythology of the long body. Now suppose one of his friends, before he went in there, and said, now look, you see, this guy, he's going to have a bowl there, and he's going to tell you you're going to see your own face. You're not. There's got another fellow there, and he's holding this. And there would be no initiation. There would be no shock. That's why mysteries have to be secret, because what is experienced for the first time.